Professor Schlesinger, notable professor of ecology and biogeochemistry, will talk to us on Eyes Wide Shut, the ethics of human response to global change.
Environment today, a little bit of philosophy and ethics of stewardship. Not a great day when you consider that, we just decided to open ANWR to drilling. And here I am talking about how we ought to manage the planet better. The juxtaposition of those two things is unfortunate. As we look at environment, you really can never give up thinking about the next day. We may get up, you look in the mirror and say we're going to lose a few battles, but maybe even 9 out of 10, but you get up and you go to work and go after the possibility of winning that 10th one and making a difference. And so I want to kind of wax in a deanly poetic fashion tonight about a few thoughts about environment and where we are, and then specifically look at climate change issues as a case of where I think not only this country has dropped the ball on leadership and environmental stewardship of the planet, but we all may suffer as a result of that. Now, I started thinking about environment back in the 60s, and one of the first things that happened that kind of focused my attention on environment was when the Cuyahoga River in the city of Cleveland caught on fire in 1969, burned down a bridge. People began to take pollution a little bit seriously in the late 60s as a result of events like that and the blowout of the oil well in Santa Barbara Channel and others. And as you look back at the 60s and those early environmental catastrophes, many of those were, of course, what we call point source pollution, kind of thing that was easy to see. And represented, of course, the general feeling of corporations and municipalities and individuals that the air and water, our air and water, were the logical place to put things you didn't want. And so off we went, putting these into the environment quite freely. And the phrase, of course, was the solution to pollution is dilution. And we expected that the atmosphere would take care of that as it blew away. And the reason I mention all that is that there are some real success stories. When we got serious about environment with the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act and the EPA, we knew how to deal with point source pollution. You could see where it was coming from, and you could analyze for it, and you knew what the cure was going to be. It may be painful, and there were some people, undoubtedly the perpetrators, that had a lot of grumbling to say about it. But what was done, there was an enormous amount of incredibly effective legislation that was put in. The fact that urban children across this country now have much lower levels of lead in their blood is one of the most astounding success stories of taking lead out of gasoline. You could say the same for the return of ospreys and bald eagles nesting in the lower 48 states from coast to coast, as opposed to their near absence in the late 60s, early 70s. Of course, this has been linked to DDT. Closer to home, when I was growing up in Cleveland, whitefish were unknown except in the history of the city in Lake Erie. Now they're fairly abundant there. So lots of good success stories that I don't think we should ever forget. Those should be the kinds of things that motivate us to get dressed, get up, go to work every day as we're working on environment. And with that background of the success of dealing with point source pollution, it's important to realize that at the same time, Rachel Carson is who I link to this, but there were those early environmentalists who noticed that actually we might be entering into yet another era that sort of foreshadowed what we now recognize as global change, that there was a different kind of pollution, something that might not be anywhere near as obvious as this, of course, she outlined in her book, The Silent Spring, quite nicely, looking at DDT and the spread of chlorinated hydrocarbons, and noted that, of course, their persistence in nature would lead to their worldwide distribution. And all of this to a new era that we now call global change, or the Anthropocene, where a single species, namely you and me, Homo sapiens, is responsible for controlling a number of the conditions for life on Earth, particularly its chemistry. And in several cases, one of which is outlined in as I go on tonight in the climate change issues, we have taken the planet into realms of chemistry, our evolutionary environment, that have never been experienced during the presence of Homo sapiens on Earth. So I credit, at the same time we were looking at success stories of the 60s, Rachel Carson and some of the others, with recognizing that we wouldn't be done with the point source pollution, that there was going to be with the growth of the human population, a large impact of humans on the planet that we must deal with. And of course, my message here tonight is that these must be taken very seriously. I could also probably say that right now this country is not taking them at all seriously, and that we must not approach these various kinds of global changes with what I chose for the title of the talk tonight, Eyes Wide Shut. This should be at the top of any kind of political or national agenda that we might have. Now, I also think it's worth thinking about why there seems to be such widespread denial about environmental problems, and I think there's maybe it's almost easy to explain that. And some of this goes to how environmentalists have approached the problem. The news from us is almost always bad. The cure is almost always unpleasant, and often the consequences of taking no action are distant. There's something we say that'll happen in 50 years. It's a global problem. It's creeping. It's changing the environment. We're all going to be miserable, but it's going to happen a long time from now. That makes it easy for people to kind of deny our agenda, deny the reality of the problem, and to look and pounce as citizens on alternative views, such as Michael Crichton's The State of Fear, Bjorn Lomborg's The Skeptical Environmentalist. If these people are right, then you can essentially let the good times roll. We have nothing to worry about. Environmentalists are just falsely alarming us. And so I think that this tendency for our fellow citizens to engage in denial, kind of warm and fuzzy denial of the problem, is at the basis of why the environmental movement and environmental scientists and environmental policymakers are having such a tough time. We also, if you look back at various writings, which I've had the propensity to do in the few years I've been running the Nicholas School, there's kind of a number of examples where humans have gone forth and subdued nature and seem to be living quite better for having done so. I recently looked through the Lewis and Clark book that Dan Botkin wrote of their journey in the early 1800s, and all along their journey through the northwestern U.S., they were fighting off grizzly bears and dealing with floods and dealing with other natural catastrophes. It sounded absolutely miserable the entire time, and yet it wasn't but a couple of decades later that the painters of the Hudson River School of in New York and spreading across the country, painted these rather idyllic scenes of humans that had tamed their environment, and having done so, seemed to be living in these wonderful pastoral settings. All kinds of good reason to look back at that and say, well, you know, maybe this environmental, managing the environment, dominating the environment, is not such a bad thing. In fact, the Bible certainly has a number of chapters in it that tell humans God's orders to exert dominion over the planet, which is so wonderfully endowed to support our multiplication and well-being as a species. Michael Northcutt, who is University of Edinburgh, has of course recently pointed out that if you look back at the original Hebrew translation of dominion, it really means something on the order of vice regent or steward, rather than a domineering and destroying manager of the landscape. God's orders was for us to exert stewardship over the planet. Now, today's problems in environment undoubtedly stem from our human population growth that took off very dramatically in this exponential fashion in the late 1800s. Actually, this graph is a little bit out of date because we're up here at about 6.3 billion people now. And you can look at that, and I certainly maintain that whatever your cause, it's a lost cause unless we do something about population. One of the early rallying calls of Earth Day in 1970, that was true, and we shouldn't forget that. But we've certainly come a long way in this population growth, and while we may work ardently every day, and I believe we should, provide the best family planning for every citizen of the planet. It will continue to grow, and that's going to be one of our underlying problems that we have to deal with. And of course, that human population is growing on a planet that, for all intents and purposes, is not growing in size, not growing in resources, not receiving interplanetary deliveries of new resources, and that produces the collision course of our number versus the environment of our future. And as our numbers grow, there seems to be no question we've made some basic changes in the chemistry of the Earth. I'm going to talk tonight a lot about climate change, but it could be just as easily overfishing, or the spread of mercury, or the dispersal of exotic and invasive species worldwide, and the natural loss of habitat from human occupation. There could be a whole litany of problems. Certainly we don't have time to listen to all of those. We'll focus on climate change, our subject tonight, and the collective activities of 6.5 billion of our number on the Earth's atmospheric chemistry and the resulting changes in climate that result from that. And all behind this, I want you to ask or think about some of the big ethical questions that our activities as a species on the planet leave before us as questions. I think these are fundamental questions about the future of the Earth. What kind of heritage do we leave for our children? Is it an imperative to leave behind a functional biosphere for the next generation? And I think there's certainly a debate on that that we see played out in the political arena. And it will be interesting to see how the educated voting citizenship of this country and around the world react to that in the next few decades. Are we to use the Earth's non-renewable resources at will, knowing that it's not getting any larger? Or is it in our ethics to leave some behind for the future generations? If global climate change impacts food production in the South, the less developed nations, is it in our ethics that the North should feed those struggling countries? And are we all that sure that our own agricultural production is secure in the face of climate change? The question of species preservation. Do species matter? How many species matter? This is a big question for biodiversity types working in biology departments across the country. But is it among our ethic to preserve the various species on planet Earth? Do they matter? And if they do matter, how are we going to decide which ones matter, which ones may matter less, and who's going to make that decision? One of my favorite thoughts on this is that I tend to be an amateur bird watcher, and of course this is a wood thrush in the eastern U.S. If I go out and shoot one of these, just as sort of a random act of unkindness, I could be hauled off and arrested from the Migratory Bird Act of a number of years ago. Somebody, certainly in the past, made the ethical decision and convinced policymakers that was a bad thing. Thou shalt not go out and shoot wood thrushes randomly, or we'll put you in jail. And yet, if I'm a developer in North Carolina, I can easily go out and bulldoze any number of trees with wood thrush nests in them, maybe even with young in them. Nobody cares. In fact, it probably adds to the GNP of the state, and I'm rewarded for economic growth there. I see that disconnect in how we've ethically approached that question as something rather intriguing. And we can just carry that one further step. If, as a citizen of the U.S., I'm sort of an average citizen and emit 5 to 6 tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere every year, I suspect we're all pretty much close to that average, that changes the climate so that wood thrushes can't nest successfully in all of eastern North Carolina or eastern U.S. Anymore, where does that fall on our ethical spectrum? There we've kind of taken hold of the problem, not by any kind of direct act of us and the wood thrush, but by making the whole area uninhabitable for them. These are all examples of where I think what the question of what behavior as humans is ethical and what behavior is unethical need to be addressed quickly, and by those that are willing to speak out on this issue and make their opinions known and hopefully develop some national policy. Now, climate change is an interesting one because I think there's certainly been more heat than light shed on the climate change issue. There are a number of people from my bottom line of environmental consciousness is the Wall Street Journal that believe that global warming is a myth, just sort of a random upward excursion of temperature and a history of temperature variations on Earth, nothing to worry about. There are some that would argue that we should just muddle through climate change because we've muddled through a number of other issues in the past and we seem to do okay. We've come out the other end without a problem. There are those that argue that there are more people living better on Earth now than ever before because of the use of fossil fuels, and therefore, why upset the apple cart of this wonderful bounty that we've mined from the Earth's crust? And those that might even argue that Adam Smith, the economist of a couple of centuries ago, was right, that actually the best way out of these issues, kind of a corollary, muddling through them, is for each person to pursue life to their own maximum benefit and happiness, and that will produce the greatest benefit and happiness for all of society. Again, I think all of these produce, kind of focus the issue of, do we go forth with eyes wide shut, or do we go forth taking some of these ethical issues in hand and try to leave a better planet for us? I'm going to argue tonight that it is fundamentally ethically wrong to ignore climate change on this planet. Our species has been here roughly 150,000 years. We're relative newcomers on planet Earth compared to the bulk of the species around us. And yet we, as relative newcomers, have had this propensity to think we're above nature and not part of it anymore. One of my colleagues I was chatting with about a few weeks ago, and he said, you know, Bill, I've never seen a field guide to the mammals actually have a human being in it. You know, we're just not, all the other species there are there, but we never have a human being in it. And that kind of reflects our approach to how we fit into nature. Sally McFade, who's in the Department of Theology at the University of Vancouver, I think put a nice quote together a few years ago about focusing on how we are actually not above and apart from nature, but actually housemates with the rest of God's creations on Earth. And as she said, as housemates, we must abide by three main rules. Take only your share, clean up after yourselves, and keep the house in good repair for future occupants. The house is loaned to us for our lifetime, and with the proviso that we obey the above rules so that it can feed, shelter, nurture, and delight those that move in after us. I think that puts a much clearer ethical relationship of Homo sapiens to the other species on the planet and the characteristics of the planet for all of us. The traditional cost-benefit analysis of economists certainly fails to incorporate, in most of the configurations I've seen, the benefits of the life support systems of planet Earth that other species give us. One can look at a forest, of course the economists would say, well, the forest has got wood there and that's valuable. And somebody might pay something to go to a forest on a weekend, so we'll include that. But never seem to include all the various, what we call, ecosystem services. The cleansing and air of water, the scrubbing of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere that a natural ecosystem, a healthy functioning forest might do for us, free of charge, those get overlooked in traditional economic analyses. And of course, in the process of overlooking, we overlook the fact that if we're doing those things ourselves, cleansing the water, cleansing the air, we have to pay that, whereas we get it for nothing from nature. So I would argue that in one first step to our ethical dilemma will be to include in cost-benefit risk analysis, not just the risk to humans, but the risk to nature, not just the benefits, direct benefits to humans, but the direct benefits of maintaining a healthy ecosystem for the function of the planet. Bob Costanza at the University of Maryland a couple of years ago made, I think, a bold first attempt to add up the value of ecosystem services globally for planet Earth. They came up with $33 trillion, which was between 1.5 and 2 times the actual economy, the human economy on the planet Earth. So nature is doing, let's say, 2 times the value to the human species of what we generate just in our own trade and commerce among us. Two times, in other words, two-thirds of what's going on unaccounted for in traditional cost-benefit analysis of humans on the planet. Now, a few years ago, Audubon Magazine published a chart in which you could calculate your impact on the planet. So I sat down one night and said this ought to be fun, called Lisa, and we added up our gasoline receipts for how many gallons of gas we used and how much electric power and gas heat and the like. Air travel was my worst component. And it turned out, when you add this up and calculated the carbon that I'd emitted to the atmosphere, the two of us emitted to the atmosphere, as a household, we would need to plant 120 trees to make up for that in the year in question. And I looked there and said, you know, we haven't planted a single tree this year. You know, we had two choices. We put our carbon dioxide in the atmosphere with impunity. We didn't worry about when we were doing it, where it went, what effect it might have. If we were going to mitigate our actions, you had two choices. Either we start planting trees like crazy, or we think about cutting back our emissions. And of course, all that's a lead up to a concept that William Rees at Vancouver developed a number of years ago, is what is our ecological footprint on the planet? And he looked at the city of Vancouver and calculated for the citizens that live there how much land area, this is the area of Vancouver right there, how much land area it would take to grow the food they ate, provide the timber and paper products they used, and to soak up the carbon dioxide from their fossil fuel use. And you can see that the area, what he called the ecological footprint, was vastly in excess of the area of the city of Vancouver. And then a couple of years ago, Mathis Wackernagel at, Stanford did this for the planet Earth, looked at how much natural landscape had to be maintained in a functional ecosystem to mitigate the effect of the human species globally. And of course, the ratio here, this is the number of Earths it would take to mitigate the impact of the human population from 1961 to 1999. Well, about 1980, our impact on planet Earth was actually exceeding more than the area of mitigation available from planet Earth. We've been essentially running down some kind of planetary bank account for the last 25 years. That worries me where we're going on this. But our ecological footprint as a species globally now exceeding the area of the planet, both land and sea, that it can be dealt with. So let's look a little bit about climate change, because I think the rise of carbon dioxide in Earth's atmosphere is one of the best examples of how the activity of human beings on the planet, collective activity of all of us, it may not be even among all of us, but certainly everybody on the planet has contributed to this, has made a fundamental change in the chemistry of planet Earth that could be soaked up if we had the proper amount of natural ecosystem set aside to do so, but in fact we haven't. And as a result, starting with the Industrial Revolution in about 1850, carbon dioxide concentrations began to rise in Earth's atmosphere quite rapidly, almost exponentially, having bounced around between about 275 and 290 parts per million in the atmosphere for some thousand or several thousands of years. The graph, these are derived from bubbles of gas collected from the Greenland ice pack. They go back farther than this, but it began to rise very, very rapidly. A prime example of a case where our species has left this huge and dramatic impact on the planet. We certainly have every reason to believe this is from fossil fuel combustion. And of course, it's easy to overlook carbon dioxide. It's odorless, colorless, non-toxic. None of us got up this morning and said, gee, the CO2 levels are awfully high today. And yet, it has this huge impact on the planet's radiation balance, which I'm sure most of the audience here has heard of, described as the greenhouse effect, because it's a very strong analogy there. The sun's radiation, visible and shortwave radiation, can pass easily through the glass of a greenhouse and warm the surfaces inside. Heat or infrared radiation has a very great difficulty getting back through glass, and so gets trapped in there, and the inside of the greenhouse warms up. Same with carbon dioxide, water vapor, and other gases in Earth's atmosphere. Essentially transparent to incoming solar radiation, but retard the outflow of infrared radiation back to space, so the atmosphere gets warmer, and we see that, of course, as climate change in that process. In fact, it's, to a large extent, really nice that some of these gases are naturally in our atmosphere, or at the planetary position of Earth from the sun, Without them, the Earth would be below freezing and would be a frozen ball of ice. So, you know, mercifully, we have a greenhouse effect, a natural greenhouse effect, or we wouldn't be here discussing tonight what the problem is of rising CO2 and additional greenhouse effect. There seems to be very little question that temperatures have increased in the last century or so. This is a plot for stations, weather stations on land, from oceanic islands, and a combination of the two. The central line in each of these graphs is the average of the overall record, and then each year is plotted downward when it's cooler than the average, and upward when it's warmer than the average. And of course, it, I think all of us would agree, most of the warm years have been recent, most of the cold years have been some time ago. The warm years seem to be getting warmer. You see that on land, you can see it over the ocean, you see it in the whole record. That seems to be a very nice documented record of climate change. A young scientist at the University of Virginia, Mike Mann, published a few years ago what has become called the hockey stick graph of climate reconstruction back to 1000 AD up to the present. He sees roughly the same thing, but now 1,000 years rather than just 100 years of U.S. Weather Bureau record. In fact, he even sees the temperature might have been on a slow decline here of some tenths to hundreds of a degree over that period. But again, with the Industrial Revolution, a rapid increase in the temperature, highly correlated with the rise in CO2 in Earth's atmosphere. This has been debated hotly in the press recently as to whether the statistics are fine and, you know, whether that rise from right there to right there might be just at the same rate as the hockey stick, the end of the hockey stick rise. I think the debate is largely focusing on the minutia and the scatter in otherwise statistical data, and overlooking this very dramatic increase in the temperature that we've seen recently. And in fact, if you plot the rise in temperature against the rise in CO2, certainly the correlation isn't one-to-one. But one would get the idea that there's some relation between the two. And of course, with the background of atmospheric physics saying that these kinds of gases should raise the temperature of a planet, there's every reason to believe that they're well related to one another. And if you look out at Venus, which has 98% carbon dioxide in its atmosphere and a surface temperature of something on the order of 474 degrees centigrade, Wally Broecker once said God put Venus in the heavens to show us all what would happen if you screwed up a planet's greenhouse effect and filled its atmosphere with carbon dioxide. And that, I think, is a very strong reminder of what to expect. I also think that this wonderful ice core from Antarctica is one of our most powerful descriptions of the linkage of temperature and carbon dioxide in the planet. In this graph, today is over here, 420,000 years is on the right. These are analyses of the carbon dioxide concentration in bubbles of gas trapped in layers of ice on the Greenland ice pack that are as old as 420,000 years ago. And those data are shown on the top here. And you can see four of the glacial-interglacial cycles. Here's a glacial, there's a warm period, another glacial, another warm period, another glacial, another warm period. Here's the last glacial, and then we warmed up had a carbon dioxide concentration of around 280 parts per million in the atmosphere. The bottom line is actually the temperature reconstructions from the isotope content of the ice. Notice the wonderful correlation between the two. Temperature tracking carbon dioxide. Here's CO2, here's temperature. CO2 was high, temperature was high. CO2 was low, temperature was low. And you can look at that and say, for the last 400 some thousand years, there seems to be some relationship between carbon dioxide and temperature globally, remembering that Homo sapiens starts right about here. So this goes well back beyond our history, and that in the last 150 years, we have done this essentially to 380 parts per million. You can look at that and say, gee, if I was a betting person, here I am in Las Vegas, what would I expect a lower graph to do? I'd expect it to go up and maintain that correlation. So we can look at planet Earth and see that a lot of changes have gone on this. There's certainly ample evidence that a number of things have shifted northward. The early migration of birds, the appearance of insects and flowering plants. One of my favorites talking in the eastern U.S. is this wonderful map that the Forest Service produced for eastern forests that show the distribution of forest cover today and the distribution of forest cover expected 50 years from now with the temperature change that might be expected. And the point I like to make when I'm talking in North Carolina is North Carolina, there's vast acreages of loblolly and slash pine that Weyerhaeuser and International Paper and private landowners have planted today, assuming that that'll be the right tree to harvest 50 years from now for their children or grandchildren's land or their shareholders. That is in the blue, loblolly pine is in the blue. And of course, what you can see is that over those 50 years, North Carolina may not be a great place for loblolly pine to be planted and live at all. The place for loblolly may be out here in Arkansas and Missouri, and that North Carolina's most dominant likely species, various kinds of oaks and hickories. And so, you know, that kind of projection of a change in forest cover, I believe, ought to alarm all of us, and particularly ought to be of interest to anybody in a corporate boardroom of a company that might have to deal with the timber products industry or explain to the shareholders 50 years from now how they screwed up. Well, we can go on from there. Here's the predictions of drought for the U.S. Looking mid-century compared to the same period in the last century. I'd say that cavalier now, the last century was a long time ago. But of course, here I am talking in Las Vegas. Notice the scale here is things in orange and yellow are going to get less rainfall in the future, things in various shades of purple more. You know, it may be very much wetter here and very much wetter in the summer in some of the desert scenarios that have been supplied. And in fact, most of the southwestern U.S. may experience very dramatic changes in rainfall. That, you know, one might look at those and say, well, that might be good for us. Rather, I'd look out here in the central portion of the U.S. and see huge drops in rainfall predicted for the center of continents that are the breadbasket of our food production, not just for the U.S., but around the world. Those alarm me in terms of thinking about our own security of food production. Also, it alarms me here that we have maybe a 20% reduction in the southeastern U.S. But these kinds of changes in climate are something that will affect us all. And while you might be in a place where you'd say, well, this might looks good for me, it may be wetter in Los Angeles, that may be true, but you may be looking at bread at $5 or $6 a loaf because the production of wheat has dropped to such low levels in the Central Plains. I don't know whether exactly this scenario will happen or not, but it's certainly likely enough that I think it should be a great concern to us. Another one is the distribution of disease. This is malaria today look at the green, essentially. Today's distribution of malaria is this hatched line. The areas in green are areas where future climate will be conducive to the existence and spread of malaria in the future. We don't think of malaria in the U.S. as any kind of a significant epidemiological problem. But you can look here and find significant areas in the southeastern U.S., across the Rio Grande Valley in Texas, down here in Arizona, strangely up here in the state of Washington, where future climate conditions may make this disease that we now think is associated merely with tropical climates something of our everyday life. The same with dengue fever. Today in the top, scarcely seen in the U.S. at all. The light blues show low risk of transmission. The darker reds and oranges show higher risk of transmission. And you can simply look in the U.S. and see lots of expanse of area where dengue or breakbone fever may be much more common in the future. The future projections of climate change for the planet show rise in the U.S. of something on the order of 5 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit on an average. It is not that kind of temperature change is not distributed evenly globally. Here you can see an outline of North and South America. Here's Africa, Southeast Asia, Australia. These are predicted temperature increases where the darkest color in centigrade here is this brownish color. And you can see that the dominant change in temperature is expected up in the polar regions of the Arctic, smaller increase down here around the Antarctic region. A large swath of the U.S. is here 1 to 5 degrees centigrade increase by the middle of the century, translating something in the order of 5 to 9 degrees by late in the century. But not distributed evenly. If you're living in Costa Rica, maybe not experiencing any change at all. It's interesting that if one looks at the satellite record of the last 30 years, this is a satellite that orbits the planet and looks down and measures a bunch of things, but it, one of the things it measures is temperature, that we're already, have already seen substantial warming up here in the Arctic regions where the future climate models predict it's exactly where they predict it ought to occur. And I take that as an early warning system that we're on this. Arctic sea ice at the North Pole has declined significantly in area, again also measured by satellite, a bunch of different satellites here and a bunch of different studies of it. I don't get hung up on the noise of the data here. All the trends show declining areas of sea ice, the maximum extent of sea ice in the Arctic Ocean every winter. We can look to Antarctica and see huge chunks. Keep this point as reference, that mountain range right there. And here it is again. This is January 2002. This huge chunk of ice breaking off and fragmenting and floating off as icebergs in the Larsen Peninsula. So you can look north and south and see a warming in progress. I'd suggest that penguins may feel it first in this process, but all of us are likely to see sea level rise. Now, this may not be at your back door in Las Vegas, but anybody with coastal property in all the big cities along the East Coast in San Francisco are destined to see sea level rise that already has been documented here in Baltimore. Now, sea level has been rising for quite a while, but you'll notice in the last decade or so, the rate of rise has itself increased. And we're now looking at the projections of melting of the ice caps raising sea level, something on the order of 18 inches globally. That's a huge change for a property of planet Earth that has been reasonably constant since the last glacial period. Associated with the melting of sea ices have been these recent graphs. I'm sorry this is so light, but again, it's the general trend that's important. These are all graphs of the change in the salinity of the surface water in the North Atlantic. As ice melts, you're of course melting fresh water and putting it into the ocean, and that fresh water input to the surface Atlantic dilutes the saltiness of the surface Atlantic and reduces the salinity. And all of these show the trend from 1965 to 2000 in the salinity in various cruises of oceanographic ships in portions of the Atlantic. They all show a decline in salinity and increasing input of fresh water there that almost has to be related. I can't think of any other process other than an increasing melting of the ice caps that would drive that. And of course, a number of us, again, Wally Broker, same guy that talked about Venus and the heavens as being a good example, has suggested that this may have a huge impact on the circulation of the oceans, and that that may be the thing that should most alarm us about climate change. Wally and others have postulated that as you put a layer of less saline, therefore less dense water up here in the North Atlantic, that the natural process that causes downwelling of water as it gets cold and heavy, it sinks into the deep ocean, may very well shut down. And that downwelling water is essentially what the Gulf Stream moving northward supplies for us all the time. And everybody has heard of the importance of the Gulf Stream at heating the Northern Hemisphere, particularly Europe. So our computer models, if you shut down the Gulf Stream, actually show a huge reversal in temperature. Now, you can look at this and say, okay, these are the cold temperatures, these are the warmer temperatures. He just showed me a graph that if we added CO2 to the atmosphere, it was going to get warm up in those regions. Now he's saying that's going to melt the ice cap, shut down the ocean circulation, Gulf Stream will quit flowing northward, and it's going to get real cold up there. And in fact, that is what I'm saying, but I'm going to ask you not to just average those two things and say, okay, one model says warm, one says cold. We don't need to worry about this. They average out to nothing. What should alarm you is the fact that, again, a single species, our species, could have this kind of effect on Earth's climate that has been so wonderfully stable for the evolution of human society for thousands of years. When I look at these kinds of temperature drops in the North Atlantic and their impacts on Europe and North America, I really worry, in combination with droughtiness there, about the security of our own food supply. Now, there are those that have argued that we can simply use planetary engineering to take care of this, add some more salt to the oceans. This was one of my favorites. If we're worried about the spread of tropical diseases, we got this wonderful chemical on the shelf that we were prohibited from using 30 years ago. We'll bring it back, knock off the mosquitoes. There are those that argue that we really ought to do nothing about global change, global warming, because to do something about it would be too great of a cost of gross national product. Eric Davidson, who works at Woods Hole, wrote this wonderful book a couple of years ago. Say, okay, you could argue that, but remember, you don't eat GNP on this. Our food, in fact, comes from the land, and we need to worry about this. So, what can we do on this? There's certainly a strong linkage between our economy, shown in blue here, our economic activity, and our rate of carbon dioxide emission from the burning of fossil fuels, shown in red. Back to the 50s, you can see a correlation here that is quite remarkable. Here's a recession, the economy was having a rough time, carbon dioxide emissions were low. Here's a boom time, carbon dioxide emissions were high. Another recession over here, another boom time. No doubt that as we look back at just the U.S., that our economy is driven by fossil fuels and we live well because of it, and other people around the world envy that lifestyle and want to do what we have done so well. And in fact, many of them are doing that. The solid graph here is human population growth over the several decades. The dashed line is energy used per person globally, recognizing that in fact, while the world has a very great unequal distribution of income between North and South, then in fact the economies of the world, even if in less developed countries, are realizing that if they go to a fossil fuel economy, they will live better and have every interest in doing so. So this is a huge problem for us, and I think we're going to have to deal with this very quickly, or we're going to have a tough time on that. The U.S. has dropped its leadership on this issue in a way that I think has been very harmful to the global community, their look at the seriousness of this problem. And it's captured in a quote that Ted Purcell, who runs Duke's campus ministry and has been teaching some classes in environmental ethics in the Nicholas School, told me that I think kind of captures this quite nicely. He describes two men that are rowing a boat on a lake, and suddenly one of them begins to bore a hole in the bottom of the boat under his seat, and the other man steps up and challenges him and says, what are you doing here? And the guy drilling the hole says, well, don't worry about it. It's none of your business. I'm drilling a hole under my own seat. That's the way I think that our country is approaching what we're doing to our global atmosphere. Why do I think we've made so little progress on a number of these issues? At least one is what I call our shifting baseline of environmental acceptability. When I was a kid growing up in Cleveland, my dad used to take me out and show me where he grew up in Cleveland as well, where he caught toads as a kid. And I stood there and looked, it was totally suburb, not a toad in sight. So we drove further out into the countryside and caught toads. When I go back to Cleveland now, where I used to catch toads, totally suburb, not a toad in sight, I don't have any kids and don't live in Cleveland, but if I were living there and wanted toads today, I'd have to drive even farther out in the country. But I have to admit, mentally, I set the baseline of environmental acceptability, kind of where what I thought was okay, not at my dad's early memories of where he caught toads, but where I caught them. And a new generation today is probably setting it even farther outside of Cleveland land. And so we've kind of subtly and without thinking about it, we've shifted the baseline of environmental acceptability and allowed a degradation to go on that I believe will ultimately not lead to good things. Jeremy Jackson at University of California at La Jolla has really documented this quite nicely under the concept of shifting baseline for marine systems. The shifting baseline, I think, explains why when I talk to groups about population growth and family planning, I find actually a warmer and more receptive audience among the older part of the audience. And I can't help but think that those are the people that can remember when the Earth only had 2.5 billion people on it, not 6.5. And the group here today is going to remember 6.5, and when it's 10 billion, we'll look back and say, well, 6.5, you know, we were doing all right at 6.5, or maybe not all right, but we got by and now we're miserable. So we have a shifting baseline of that that I think really sets back progress on this. So I want to offer you a suggestion that is a little probably unusual to expect from somebody who's spent 30 years doing environmental chemistry and certainly is steeped in the environmental science end of thing. The scientists can tell us all and ought to tell all of our citizens how the world works. We're good at that. And we can identify ways that humans are upsetting planet Earth, and we ought to document those as fully as you can with the ice core record and temperature records and salinity records, and try to leave behind a quantitative record that avoids the shifting baseline problem of toads and others. We can do that wonderfully. The thing that I think we should also do as environmental scientists and policymakers is work closely with our religious organizations that have the ear of the people, particularly in this country, that can look at their teachings using the Bible, where humans play a role as stewards of nature, and make that real for their congregations every morning. And of course, the fraction of the U.S. that goes to some kind of faith service every week is enormous and influential. We can connect an environmental stewardship ethic to a conservative ethic, when conservation really meant conserving nature in this country, using our science to reflect the importance of this and to document the changes and to show how serious we are about it. But to get the religious organizations to convey this and build constituency in their congregations across the country. The National Religious Partnership for Environment, for instance, has already taken a firm stand that global climate change is an absolutely serious issue that should be addressed. And I believe that actually the only groups that collectively could get organized and speak out with the same kind of impact as the large corporate groups, with the same influence on politicians and the same access, maybe not in lump sum contributions, but the collective financial impact, would be the faith communities of this country. So science can't do this alone. This is really an appeal from a scientist, and I hope with the support of other scientists, that we have a job to do educating the public about the importance of changes in our environment, global changes, and that they, through their communities of faith, can help spread that message across the country and have the greatest impact. I think how we deal with these issues may very well determine whether our population, which of course is now growing like this exponentially and showing all signs of being similar to the growth of a population of reindeer on a small island off Alaska, very similar shape to that curve. And what happened to the population of reindeer off the coast of Alaska? Essentially overconsumed all food contents of that island, and the population collapsed to very low levels. I think we can do better than that. We claim that Homo sapiens is this wonderful species that's smarter than that, smarter than all the other species, ought to be able to manage the planet Earth. We ought to be able to avoid this kind of fate for our population and at the same time leave behind a functional environment for the future. And let me finally just say that our island is planet Earth. It's out there. The astronauts saw it in 1969 and subsequent trips to the moon looking back at it. It's not getting any larger. I don't expect anytime soon that there's going to be an interplanetary delivery of resources to this planet of any variety. With Sally McVeigh, I believe we need to manage this home well. It really is our only home out there. We need to have our eyes open to the degradation that's going about it, informed by science, and with the science informing public opinion through communities of faith and other organizations to get that message out and have all of our policymakers and political leaders realize that we care about this and that it depends, the future of the human species depends on it. Otherwise, I see no future other than to think about what happens as life on this planet might succumb and leave it as a cold ball against this black backdrop of outer space. And let me stop there. It's been fun talking with you here tonight, and I believe we'll do a few questions. Thanks.
I want to thank Bill for his wonderful talk and his willingness to do some Q&A. So please, go ahead.
Yes. So the question is the idea that extreme weather events, droughts, hurricanes, typhoons, might be more frequent and more severe in warmer climates of the future. I didn't present that tonight because that does kind of fall into some of the more speculative ends of things. But I have to admit, that speculation is becoming more and more uniform as coming out of the climate models. And it is based largely on the idea that a warmer atmosphere will lead to greater evaporation rates of water vapor out of the world's oceans. And that essentially puts more water vapor in the atmosphere that will rain out somewhere on the planet when it runs into colder air, presumably at higher latitudes. And so there's lots of reason to think that the physics would suggest that a warmer atmosphere will be an energized atmosphere. It'll have a lot of water vapor in it. And that hurricanes will be of greater magnitude. Most of the models are suggesting greater magnitude, but not greater numbers. Whether or not, as I said, these are, I think, still in the realm of what scientists are working on. This is what makes the science fun, is we can still argue about those things. The jury's still out on what the models are saying. But I'm seeing more and more of it. I think it's a very real possibility. The question is, do methane and nitrous oxide have a contribution to greenhouse warming in the future? The answer is yes. They're rising in the atmosphere now, and as they rise in the atmosphere, they will have an increasing effect. Methane, molecule for molecule, people argue about the exact figure, but something on the order of 20 times the effect of a molecule of CO2. Nitrous oxide, laughing gas, dentist's office gas, something on the order of 200 times molecule for molecule. Mercifully, they're starting at lower levels, and in the case of nitrous oxide, rising only slowly. But they are rising, and a number of people say it might actually be easier to tackle methane than to tackle CO2 to get the initial treatment of reducing the potential of greenhouse warming. That may also be true. And it's interesting, I mean, methane, we get it from rice paddies and leaking gas pipelines and some things that you might be able to do something about. It also comes from cows that might be more difficult to do something about. You know, that's the kind of dispersed source that's hard to capture. But I, again, in the interest of time, I didn't talk about all of them tonight, but certainly judicious ways of reducing the growth of some of those other gases might have, you might actually get more bang for your buck in terms of reducing the potential for global warming. Yes? In other words, how should scientists and others inform faith communities of this message? Let me be very personal about that. I've given a talk, generally an invitation, at a number of Episcopal and Methodist church groups in the state of North Carolina that have always invited me. You know, they hear about climate change, so they say, well, we'll get the dean of the school to come and talk to us on Saturday night or something. Well, that's the night of dissipation, I guess, so we don't do it Saturday night. Friday night.
Not the Methodist.
Yeah. And basically, I find this a group that wants to hear the latest from a scientist. And when they do, I felt a certain, you know, gee, we didn't know things were this bad. We ought to be doing something about this collectively as a group. We ought to be speaking out as a church in our diocese leading up to the highest levels of the religious organization that would carry the message to the White House and Capitol Hill. So I think that if you are in science, working on these kinds of issues from biological or geological or hydrological point of view, reach out to those groups. When they call, accept the invitation. When you have a message that can be written into an op-ed or an editorial for the newspaper, write it and get it out there. And that essentially we can build a grassroots support for this that could be carried through the faith communities and make a difference. It will be very much an effort that all of us can do, and we all need to be motivated to do it on top of everything else we do on a daily basis. Okay, so the question is, if there is a good correlation, and I think the data show it, between economic activity and fossil fuel usage over the last several decades, how are we going to essentially sell an argument of cutting back on fossil fuel usage? That is certainly not going to be an easy argument to sell. In fact, it may be impossible to sell with that kind of bare bones description of it. And yet there's a number of alternatives out there that we haven't pursued at all. We may be pursuing them without knowing it with the rising price of petroleum on the world market, driven by the demand of others on the planet, that make us think about what kind of vehicle and how often we drive from one place to another. Make us think about whether we want to have coal-fired power plants or photovoltaics and wind power where we can do it. In other words, various kinds of economics, rising prices for energy as it gets short, that will drive an efficiency and an increase in renewables for the world. I hold out faith for those, but I really do think they can make a difference, and they will make a difference if we do some logical things like the Europeans and tax fossil fuels, and make people think about the price of gasoline when they fill their car, and motivate good chemical engineers to develop new processes to produce energy in renewable ways. So it's not going to be easy. I think this may be the hardest environmental problem that we can think of and that we've ever tackled. How do you uncouple the livelihood of the world's population from these wonderful liquids and solids that we mine from the surface of the earth and burn to make life better for all of us? Make food production easy, keep us warm, have the lights on tonight, shine the PowerPoint, everything that we do that we weren't doing in the 1700s. That's going to be tough. But I think we can do that, and with judicious planning of it, we could kind of slide that into the economy where it would probably have relatively little noticeable immediate effect. So the question is essentially, what do we do? Yeah. What kind of message do we get out? Politics and environmentalism starts locally, you know, leading by example, and you know, all the things we do in a daily life that consume energy unnecessarily, you can start by cutting back on those and talking that up to those that are willing to listen.